So there was a recent poll done for an internet search company, probably Google, but other search companies are available, and it sought to answer the question, what is the most difficult question we can ask? What is the most difficult question in the world? And number one was this question, what is the meaning of life? That, according to Google, is the toughest question in the world. That beat out other questions in the poll. Number two on the list was the question, what is love? Not such a hard question, apparently. What is the meaning of life also beat out other really important and existential questions. Questions like, why is abbreviation such a long word? Ever wondered that one? And it also beat one of my favorite questions that someone submitted to the poll. Why do you never see baby pigeons? Ever thought struck you? They appear fully formed, but baby ones apparently don't exist. But those questions were beaten by the question, what is the meaning of life? And that question turns up all over the place. You can ask that question personally, for example. Imagine that your phone was to buzz right now, and your phone was to buzz, and on it was a message from a friend saying, meet me downstairs in reception right now. Stop whatever you're doing, come and meet me for coffee. What would you text back? You probably would text back the word, why? You'd want to know why, wouldn't you? You would ask your friend to justify the 10 or 15 minutes of your life that they're asking for. Yet most people on this planet can't justify their entire lives. We ask our friends to justify their use of our time, but many of our friends can't justify their entire lives. And unless you can justify your life, you can't answer the meaning question. And this question of meaning turns up in all over our culture, doesn't it? It turns up in movies. Loads of movies wrestle with the question, what is life all about? Think of recent movies like The Tree of Life, one of my favorite slightly older movies, The Truman Show, or even further back, It's a Wonderful Life, classic Hollywood movie, all centered around this question, what is life all about? It turns up in TV shows, doesn't it? Things like like Westworld, huge recent hit on Netflix, or The Good Place, another big streaming show. Those whole shows are constructed around the question, what is the meaning of life? The question turns up in books. Think of Yann Martel's The Life of Pi, phenomenal book, also best up, a hujely popular movie, or Kazuo Ishiguro's story, Never Let Me Go. Huge Pulitzer Prize nominated, Man Booker Prize nominated novels, all wrestling with the question, what does it mean to be human? And of course, by the way, it turns up in music, and I'm going to reveal my prejudices or my likes here, because I've only given you one option. U2's classic, I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For. And of course, recognizing we have easels all around the room, it turns up in art, doesn't it? Everything from Edvard Munch's The Scream, Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man, or Damien Hirst, right up to the present day, his statue Verity, which stands overlooking the harbour in the town of Ilfracombe in the UK, just about 12 miles from where my parents live. I have walked and sailed past that statue many times, wrestling with the question, what is life all about? Why is our culture so fascinated with the meaning question? Why is our culture so fascinated with that question? Well, perhaps because of an observation that the great Austrian psychiatrist and Holocaust survivor Viktor Frankl wrote in one of the best-selling books of the 20th century. He wrote these words, as the struggle for survival has subsisted, the question has emerged, survival for what? Ever more people today have the means to live, but no meaning to live for. Ever more people today have the means to live, but no meaning to live for. And of course, the question of the meaning of life that he's identifying there as a psychologist is especially crucial when adversity or disaster or suffering strike us, as those things invariably will. You know, if you're living in Ukraine at this moment, or if you're wrestling with a bereavement or a devastating medical diagnosis, the question what life is really all about is crucial. In fact, one of the most famous atheists of the 19th and 20th centuries, also possessor of the most amazing moustache in the history of philosophy, that's quite impressive, Friedrich Nietzsche, he put it this way, he who has a why to live for can bear almost any how. In other words, the famous atheist is saying, once you have figured out what life is really about, then you can deal with suffering and adversity much more powerfully, much more easily. But of course, to ask questions about the meaning of life, to ask what life is all about, is really to ask the more focused question, what is a human being? What is it that we are here for as humans? Are we made for something? Are we just an accident of time plus chance? Or is there something more going on? And so this huge question that turns up all across art and literature, all across our culture, this meaning question, is really part of the much bigger question of what does it mean to be human? And that's the question we're going to think about over the next half an hour or so. Now, what's interesting, when you start asking this question, what does it mean to be human? Everybody is keen to have a go at that question. And my secular friends, my atheist friends, they want to have a go at this question as well. And of course, they try and answer this question purely in secular terms, purely in material terms, without allowing God so much as a foot in the door. Let me give you a flavor of what those answers might look like. Here is Stephen Jay Gould, very influential writer and scientist, paleontologist, died a few years ago, but a brilliant wordsmith. And this is his attempt to wrestle with the what does it mean to be human question as an atheist. Gould writes, he says, the human species has inhabited this planet for only 250,000 years or so, roughly 0.00015% of the history of life, the last inch, as it were, of the cosmic mile. The world fared perfectly well without us for all but the last moment of earthly time. And that fact makes our appearance look more like an accidental afterthought than the culmination of a prefigured plan. We are here because one odd group of fishes had a peculiar fin anatomy that could transform into legs for terrestrial creatures. We are here because comets struck the Earth and wiped out dinosaurs, thereby giving mammals a chance not otherwise available. So thank your lucky stars in a quite literal sense. We are here because the Earth never froze entirely during an ice age, because a small and tenuous species arising in Africa a quarter of a million years ago has managed, so far, by hook or by crook, to survive. We may yearn for a higher answer, but none exists. This explanation, although superficially troubling, is also ultimately liberating and exhilarating. We cannot read the meaning of life in the facts of nature. We must construct the answers ourselves from our own wisdom and ethical sense. There is no other way. And I hope as you hear those words, even though they might disturb you and trouble you and intrigue you, you are nevertheless struck by the fact this is very powerful writing. You can see why his books had such an impact. He takes big skeptical ideas and he puts them into very powerful sort of words that communicate well, and his books have sold millions of copies. He is, of course, playing a little bit fast and loose with the facts. If the picture that he paints is correct, then actually there is no meaning, period. Not merely no meaning to be found, but no meaning to be created. For example, if I was to take a group of Scrabble tiles from that letter tiles from that popular word game and throw them down on the floor in front of us here, those letters would have no meaning, period. Even if a few letters happened to spell out coffee at 11:30, that would actually not be any kind of meaning. It would just be sheer luck. There would be no meaning in those letters to be found. Yet that is where we find ourselves as human beings, if Stephen Jay Gould is correct. We are biology and just biology. Nothing more, but certainly nothing less for sure, but nothing more at the same time. Now, the idea that we are just biology and only biology is, of course, expressed by other atheists too. Another atheist whose books have sold millions of copies, Richard Dawkins of Oxford University, his book The God Delusion has sold something like 7 million copies, which tells me even if Richard doesn't believe in God, his agent must be thanking God every day. And listen to Richard's bleak take on the human condition. We are survival machines. We are robot vehicles blindly programmed to preserve these selfish molecules known as genes. Our genes made us. We animals exist for their preservation, and we are nothing more than throwaway survival machines. The world of the selfish gene is one of savage competition, ruthless exploitation, and deceit. I often look at quotes like this and I think to myself, this is why Richard is an atheist writer and not a motivational speaker. Anytime you're feeling a bit too confident, look yourself in the mirror and say, I am just a throwaway survival machine. Now, of course, if Richard is right, if Stephen is right, there's some profound questions that rise from that. Not least, it would seem to imply nihilism. It would seem to imply that there is clearly no meaning in a random universe like this. It would also imply the end of ethics, quite frankly, because what does it matter what one group of selfish genes does to another group of selfish genes? And I would also suggest to you this morning, it would imply the end of beauty and art, quite frankly, because if the only thing that matters is survival and reproduction, where quite does art and music and beauty fit into that story? In fact, wrestling with that question, I think, lies behind these tragic words of yet another atheist, Albert Camus, the French existentialist atheist. He once made this remark. He said, beauty is unbearable. Beauty is unbearable. It drives us to despair, offering us for a minute the glimpse of an eternity that we should like to stretch out over the whole of time. I find these haunting words that as an atheist, he recognized that beauty was there, but he hated, he found despairing the questions that it raised, because for him as an atheist, it promised something that wasn't real. And he lived in this terrific tension between wanting to enjoy beauty, but hating where he felt it led. Now, don't get me wrong. I enjoy the candor. I admire the candor of a Stephen Jay Gould. I appreciate the honesty of Richard Dawkins. I admire the courage of a Camus to kind of face this. But it tells me that these staggeringly bleak conclusions that follow destroy any possible answer from atheism of the question, what does it mean to be human? For that, we need a much richer worldview. We need something like the biblical answer. So what is the Christian answer to this question? What does it mean to be human? What are we? Who are we? If naturalistic atheism can't help us, can the Bible offer anything? Well, I would say yes, it can. And staggeringly and surprisingly and startlingly and amazingly, the Bible's answer to the question what it is to be human actually occurs in the very first chapter of the very first book of the Bible. Because in Genesis chapter 1, we read a statement that is mind-blowing in its scope and foundational in its importance. Words that will be familiar to all of us from Genesis chapter 1. Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. Now, this claim here in Genesis that human beings bear the image of God, what theologians would call the Imago Dei, is utterly unique to Christianity. You will not find any such statement in the Quran. My academic background is actually Quranic studies. My PhD is in the Quran, not the Bible. So I'm quite unusual as a Christian theologian in that regard. The Quran in Islam says nothing like this. If you turn to the scriptures of Hinduism, if you read the Bhagavad Gita, you would find nothing like this. There is nothing like that statement in any other religious text. Only the Bible makes this terrifically high claim about what it means to be human. But this is not just some theological idea. It's an idea that is absolutely foundational for two reasons. The subtitle to this morning's talk was Why It Matters That We Bear God's Image. And it matters for two reasons. It matters because it gives us a ground for value, and it matters because it gives us a foundation for ethics. Let's talk about those two things briefly for a few minutes. Let's begin with value. The first thing that the biblical teaching that you and I, every human being, are made in the image of God does is it gives us a rock-solid, concrete foundation for your value and identity. According to the Bible, it doesn't matter what your race, gender, age, ability, height, thankfully, as someone who doesn't even quite make 5'8", doesn't matter what you've done, doesn't matter what your record is, none of those things matter, because you are made in the image of God and thus have infinite value and worth. Now, here's the thought experiment. I often would do versions of this talk to very skeptical audiences, being an evangelist. I mean, you look like a very friendly audience this morning, but sometimes I have to talk to Baptists. And I'll pick on other denominations later. Take this idea away, and you're left with the struggle of how do you determine the value of a human life. Everyone wants to believe that human beings have value and a value and worth, but I will often say to my secular friends, how do we find a basis if we throw God out of the picture? So let's do an experiment this morning. Imagine we were chemists here this morning. If I was a chemist, I might grab hold of Charles, because he's directly in my eye line, which is always dangerous, and I'll drag him away to my secret laboratory buried underneath the hotel here, and I will put him into a test tube. And I'll boil him up to his constituent chemicals. So much potash, so much sodium, so much carbon, all the bits that formerly made Charles. And then we can stick those on eBay and see what they're worth. And it's been calculated that the average human being is actually worth roughly $7 US in terms of the parts that make you up. Which tells me that this is probably not a good way to value a human being. Okay, so if we can't go the chemical route, what else can we do? Maybe if I was a psychologist, we could look how smart you were, and we could say, okay, those of you whose IQ is a certain amount, you're worth this amount, and those of you who are not quite so smart, sorry, you're not worth as much this morning. But most of us, I imagine, would react instinctively against that. We would find abhorrent the idea that we assign people's worth based on intelligence. Well, now what do we try? Well, I guess if we were sociologists, we might value you based on how the community values you. We could see how many friends each one of you have this morning, both the real type of friends and the pretend ones that you accumulate on social media. And the more popular, we say those people are worth more, and those of you who have less friends are worth less. Again, probably a fairly monstrous way to value people. Well, now, the last option I guess we could try if we were going to be wholly secular, maybe if we were economists this morning, and by the way, if you're not sure what an economist is someone who can tell you tomorrow why the prediction they made yesterday was wrong today. An economist might look at you and say, well, we'll assess your worth based on the size of your bank balance, or if you're a student, your earning potential. We'll value you in economic terms. And again, most of us would look at this and say, that's terrible. We mustn't do that to people. All of us know instinctively that human value is not derived from the chemicals that you're made of, how intelligent you are, your relationships, or your economic production. If we go that route, we are in trouble. Now, this thought experiment, by the way, is not purely theoretical. Yes, it got a few cheap laughs, but it's not purely theoretical. It has some very contemporary applications. Consider, for example, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, one of the most important legal documents in human history, ratified on the 10th of December 1948. And in the introduction to that famous document, we read these words: recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. We are passionate about human rights. We award Nobel Prizes for human rights. We make movies and documentaries and art about human rights. But there's a fairly basic question that our world tends to overlook. These rights, this value, this dignity that this document talks about, where is it located? What's its basis? However beautiful those words on the screen may sound, are they actually true? And I always say to my skeptical friends, there is only one place, there's only one worldview that I know of that can sustain this kind of language, and that's the biblical idea that human beings bear the imago Dei, the image of God, because only that answer tells you that your value comes from outside, not from what you do. And amazingly, it's actually not just Christians who recognize this. One of the most influential French atheists writing today is a man called Luc Ferry. He wrote a best-selling book a few years ago called A Brief History of Thought. And he remarks in that book, surveying European history, he said, in the Greco-Roman world, in the world of our ancestors, it was taken as a given that some people were inferior to others. It was taken as a given by the Greeks and the Romans and so on that slaves and women and children were worth less. And thus, he concludes, he said, in direct contradiction to that Greek world, Christianity introduced the notion that humanity was fundamentally identical, that people were equal in dignity. That was an unprecedented idea at the time, and it is an idea to which our world owes its entire democratic inheritance. But this notion of equality did not come from nowhere. And he goes on in the chapter from which I took that in his book to say how grateful he actually is to Christianity as an atheist, even though he doesn't believe our claims about God. He thinks Christianity gave the world this tremendous gift with that concept. So the biblical teaching that human beings bear the imago Dei, that we have the image of God, is the only secure ground for human value. It's also the only secure ground, actually, for something else, something closely connected, and that's ethics and how we treat one another. And the point about treating one another well and with dignity and with value was actually made beautifully and very powerfully by a very famous Christian writer from the 20th century, with whom many of us will be familiar, C.S. Lewis. And C.S. Lewis, one of his most influential shorter pieces of writing was a sermon that he first gave in Oxford called The Weight of Glory, that was then later published as an essay and a collection of essays. And he talks in this about what it means to take this Christian understanding of being in God's image seriously. Let me read you these words of C.S. Lewis. He says, it's a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses, to remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. All day long, we are, in some degree, helping each other to one or other of those destinations. It is in the light of those overwhelming possibilities. It is with the awe and the circumspection proper to them that we should conduct all our dealings with one another, all friendships, all loves, all play, all politics. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations and cultures, arts, civilization, these are mortal, and their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. But it is immortals with whom we joke, work, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal horrors or everlasting splendors. Next to the Blessed Sacrament itself, your neighbor is the holiest object presented to your senses. Now that again is not just a theological idea or a literary idea or an artistic idea. It plays out in the everyday world too. Let me give you one, again, contemporary example. Among all the world's people groups, the Dalits of India have experienced some of the world's greatest sadness and pain and persecution. The Dalits sit at the very bottom of India's highly stratified caste system, and they are considered in their culture to be untouchable. Dalit women often bear the brunt of this, and 2/3 of Dalit women have been sexually abused. 750,000 have been trafficked into sexual slavery. Yet the conviction rate for crimes against Dalits hovers around 5%. How do you change a mindset that says that a person is quite literally worth less because of her caste, because of her family, because of her birthplace? It's all very well saying words like, well, all people are equal. That is just a fine-sounding soundbite to people who daily experience this kind of persecution. I read an interview not that long ago with a Dalit religious leader who summed up the problem. He said, the problem in our culture is by the time a child is just 14 years old, they have been told their entire life that they are worthless. And then he said, the only way to correct this, we have found, is from a very young age, we need to speak a different worldview into the ears of our children. And the Dalits are finding that it's the biblical worldview, it's the Christian worldview that tells us that all of us bear God's image and all are equal, that is a powerful corrective. And if you Google this, you will find that the Christian faith is spreading like wildfire among the Dalit community in India, because that message that all are equal before their creator is an incredible and unique message in that culture. And in fact, I'm reminded of the words of another deeply influential Christian writer, G.K. Chesterton, who put it nicely. He was the king of the soundbite before Twitter was invented. What Chesterton would make and do with Twitter, I have no idea. But he said this once. He said, all people are equal as all pennies are equal, because the only value in any of them is they bear the image of the king. With apologies to any Americans present, but you know you want to rejoin Great Britain again, we realize this. The question of what it means to be human is really important. And I think only the Bible can answer the question of why we have value in any meaningful way, not reducing us to our atoms or sociology or other things. But there is one other side to the question we need to talk about for 5 minutes or so, and it's this. We need an answer to the question, what does it mean to be human, that addresses our value and our dignity, but also addresses the fact that we are flawed. See, one of the challenges for secularism is to explain why human beings go wrong in so many ways. It doesn't matter how much education, how much politics, how much technology you apply, human beings do not end up at secular utopias. What has gone wrong with us? I thought one of the people I think who identifies this powerfully is the poet, Randall Jarrell, American poet, who remarked this. He said, most of us know now that Rousseau was wrong, that man, when you knock his chains off, sets up the death camps. Soon we shall know everything the 18th century didn't know and nothing that it did, and it will be hard to live with us. But why are these words true? If humans are made in the image of God, why is it we are so often beastly to one another? Well, I wonder here if it's helpful to reflect just very quickly on the nature of an image. You see, inherent in the idea of the word image is the idea of reflection. So if human beings were created in God's image, that means we were designed, we were intended to reflect God, to image God's glory to the world. And then the question becomes for every human being, if you're not going to choose to reflect God, what are you going to reflect? Every single human being angles the mirror of their soul at something. And if it's not God, it's going to be things like money, sex, work, performance, or even, heaven forbid, we end up becoming like Narcissus of Greek legend, so transfixed by our own image, our own beauty, our own cleverness, our own reputation. But of course, all of those things will ultimately destroy you if you try and make them the center of your lives, because no mirror can be the source of its own light. One of the most influential Western novelists in recent years is this gentleman, David Foster Wallace, a name that may be known to some of you in this room, particularly those of you who are into writing and literature. Very influential postmodern novelist, Pulitzer Prize nominated. Not a Christian, a man who wrestled with life's big questions, but was at best agnostic when it came to matters of faith. Well, at a commencement address he gave at, I think from memory, Stanford University in the US some years ago, he made one of the most interesting comments on the human condition I think I've ever read anywhere, at least in any contemporary writer. Foster Wallace writes this. He says, in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough, never feel you have enough. It is the truth. If you worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, well, you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. If you worship power, you will feel weak and afraid. You will need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, and you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out, and so on. And what Wallace is nudging at here is that if you make one of those other things the source of your life and the center of everything, then you need it. You're a bit like an addict. You have to have that thing. And because you need it, you become afraid of losing it. You become afraid of losing your academic reputation or your relationship or your job or your standard of living. And the problem is that means that thing then ends up controlling you. And if you end up trying to serve your career or your success or your reputation and you fail, that will crucify you inside with anxiety and jealousy and loathing. And no wonder so many modern people are so messed up. But the good news of the gospel is at the heart of the Christian faith. Our identity is built not on one who asks us to crucify ourselves by performing and earning, but one who is crucified for us. So the solution then, how do we deal with this problem that the mirror of the human soul is cracked and broken and distorted? Well, that theme of the image of God that begins in Genesis runs right the way through the scriptures. And I think the climax, the zenith of that theme comes in Colossians chapter 1, where the Apostle Paul writes, "For God has rescued us from the dominion of darkness. He's brought us into the kingdom of the Son that he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were made, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the head of the church, the body. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have supremacy. For God was pleased to have all of his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross." So according to the Bible, Jesus Christ is the perfect image of God. And he was willing to be trampled on and rejected and broken so that our broken image might be remade, forgiven, restored, and redeemed. And of course, the whole story of what Jesus did as he hung there on that cross is the promise of restoration, the promise and the power to restore that image of God in us that we've allowed to become marred and broken. See, the wonderful news, my friends, is that human beings are not just matter, but we do matter. We are more than the stuff of which we are made, more than our production, more than our relationships, more than our psychology. We are image bearers with incredible value and significance, and value shown, demonstrated by the fact that Jesus, that God, was willing to pay that price for us to restore our broken image so that the mirror of our souls might be angled at him as it was intended. And the beautiful thing is this is not just a great encouragement for us this morning. I think powerful gospel-orientated conversations can begin from that whole question of what it means to be human. Try asking a friend, a neighbor, a colleague, hey, do you think human beings have value? And if they say yes, unless you're living next door to a sociopath, you can gently ask the question, why do you think we have value? And that creates an open door to begin talking about the uniqueness of the Christian message here.